From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Sometimes even communities we think we know really are full of surprises.
There must be a mistake. This is platform 9 3/4. There's no such thing. Is there? Can you tell me where I might find platform 9 3/4?
9 3/4? Think you're being funny, do you?
Today we go underground to visit the original Rome, Georgia, and we'll jam out with the New Orleans group Tank and the Bangas, winner of NPR's Tiny Desk Contest. But first, please, just take a couple of minutes to support this show and everything you hear on it. We're in the middle of our fall fund drive. Just go to gpb.org and click donate, or call 1-800-222-4788. It's easy peasy and very quick. A recent study by WalletHub ranks Atlanta as the 9th most pet-friendly city in America. Like many of you, I'm a very proud dog mom. I can't tell you how many times that I wish I knew what my dog was saying to me. But what if dogs could talk with humans like this?
Excuse me. My owner needs your attention.
That was sound generated from a vest that can help service dogs communicate. It was developed as part of Georgia Tech's FIDO project. Melody Jackson leads that initiative, and she's the director of Georgia Tech's Center for Biointerface Research. In 2015, I talked with her and Greg Burns. He directs the Center for Neuropolicy at Emory University, and he's author of the new book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. Greg studies the behavior of dogs using an MRI machine. So naturally, I had to ask him how he keeps dogs still while they're being screened through an MRI.
With lots of training and lots of treats.
Lots of treats. Well, treats always work. Well, let's talk a little bit about dogs. But Melody, I wanted to start off by kind of getting an overview of what this vest project is expected to do. It's not necessarily actually trying to interpret the thoughts of dogs.
That's correct, Celeste. The FIDO project, which stands for Facilitating Interactions for Dogs with Occupations, acronym actually, is about letting an assistance dog or any kind of a working dog give more clear information to their handler. And I'll tell you a quick story. If you have epilepsy and you have a medical alert dog, these dogs can detect seizures long before their owner knows that they're about to have a seizure. And what they usually do is they'll back the person up against a wall so that they don't fall down. And then when the person does have the seizure and is unconscious, they'll lick their face. But what if that dog could activate a sensor on their service dog vest that would actually call 911 and not just have the dog stay with the person, but literally summon help? It could be life-changing.
And this could be used in a lot of different ways, but the concept behind this is not that we're letting the dog speak, but that we have pre-chosen sentences or messages that the dog learns so that they can send that message in particular situations.
Correct. Another scenario is a hearing dog. So a hearing dog assists someone who is deaf, and they alert to sounds, and then they'll usually lead their owner to the source of the sound. So if the doorbell rings or someone calls your name or the baby's crying, the dog will lead you to the source of that sound. But what if the sound is a tornado siren? The dog can't take you to the source of that sound, and they have no way of telling you what sound they just heard. So the FIDO vest would allow the dog to tell you what sound they just heard and hopefully make a much better decision about how to respond.
And interestingly enough, we're going to go to Greg in a moment in terms of what this all means about a dog's intelligence. But interestingly enough, Melody, there's all kinds of particular dogs. I was interested to read the part about dogs who are finding, say, a child who's lost. In the past, the dog would chase down the missing person, right, go find them, and then they'd have to run all the way back to get the rescue professionals and bring them to wherever that person was.
That's exactly right. That's called a recall and refind. So the person sends the dog out, the search and rescue officer, and the dog hopefully finds their target. But now they're a mile away from their handler oftentimes. The dogs are much faster than people. So the dog has to refind their handler and then refind the person that they were looking for. And this can waste valuable time. As well as we had a situation not too long ago where a young man who was on the autism spectrum was lost in the North Georgia mountains. And every time the dogs got nearby, he was afraid and he ran. So that meant they had to start the search all over again. If the dog could just activate a sensor on their vest that would communicate to their handler, here I am, here's my GPS location, and I'm going to stay with this person, it could help immensely in the search process.
So, Greg, we've been hearing, I mean, I guess as researchers like yourself begin to study the minds of domesticated canines more and more, we start to hear more about what dogs are capable of. And in some ways, it's surprising. We recently had those results that showed that dogs could actually tell the difference between a sad face and an angry face, and I think an anxious face. I can't remember all the different emotions they could tell. Just from the expression on a human being's face. And as far as I understood it, that was the first time a non-human species was actually proven to be able to detect those things. Is that correct?
Well, no, not exactly. I mean, that type of capability chimpanzees can do, and even monkeys can do to some degree, at least with other monkeys, and you know whether they can do it with humans is debatable. So other primates can do it. That's probably the first demonstration of a non-primate doing that.
Right. So what does this tell us about dogs in terms of their intelligence? Are they evolving to become better matches with humans?
Well, you know, we don't really talk about intelligence as kind of one thing. We don't talk about it that way with humans and certainly not with animals. And I think what we're seeing is that what dogs have become and differentiated from wolves is they are really masters of social intelligence. And that's really what distinguishes them from wolves, is their ability to get along with and live with other species, humans primarily. But, you know, we've all seen, you know, pictures and videos of dogs with many other animals, and that's really what they're good at.
Melody, are there particular breeds that you're working with?
Well, we intentionally work with a variety of breeds, but most of the breeds that we're working with are typical assistance dog breeds, so retrievers. We are using border collies, but we've even tested a little tiny papillon. We've tested a pit bull. So we're very interested in general, you know, dog intelligence and dog capabilities, but we are working pretty intensely with Canine Companions for Independence, which is the oldest and largest provider of service dogs in the United States.
That is Melody Jackson of the Center for Biointerface Research at Georgia Tech. We also heard from Greg Burns of the Center for Neuropolicy at Emory University. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about technological innovations to help dogs and humans communicate. That would make my life easier. My guests are Melody Jackson of the Center for Biointerface Research at Georgia Tech and Greg Burns of the Center for Neuropolicy at Emory University. Greg has a book out called What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. I spoke with both of them in 2015, and I asked Greg if it's possible to separate dog breeds based on intelligence.
Breeds are just kind of very crude and broad categories of dogs that largely describe their appearance. And really what you're asking is not so much about appearance, but, you know, behaviorally, will I get along with this particular type of dog?
Yeah, the personality, right.
Exactly. And that's not really that closely linked to breeds as, you know, the AKC defines them. And, you know, I agree with Melody that these are individual traits more than breed traits. And, you know, the important thing for people selecting dogs is to find the dog that's right for you.
Okay, but this leads us into a controversial subject, Greg, and let's talk about the pit bulls. Melody just mentioned the really smart pit bull that they worked with, but this comes up all the time, especially recently, in terms of people saying that pit bulls are simply a dangerous and aggressive breed. It sounds like you're saying there's no such thing as a dangerous and an aggressive breed.
That's what I believe, yes. So I am against breed-specific legislation because, you know, it's basically a form of canine bigotry, defining an entire group of dogs based on a breed. And pit bulls aren't a breed anyway. You know, the closest thing is a Staffordshire Terrier.
Well, so, okay, let's bring this back into the normal pet. Most people aren't going to be working with the kind of highly trained dogs that you and Melody are. But I wonder if, as we begin to get these inklings of social intelligence and other kind of smarts among our canines that we have at home, does that put a responsibility on us as pet owners to stimulate them mentally?
That's a good question. There's certainly been kind of a proliferation of products appearing that would do that. You know, you can get dog TV now and, you know, kind of, I guess, feel better about, you know, leaving your dog home alone.
I guess.
I think what you're asking is just kind of part of being a responsible pet owner. Whether
the ethics of it, as we begin to understand more about this animal and we don't think of it just as a brainless beast, does that change our ethics in our treatment of these of dogs?
I think so. I mean, certainly the more that I've studied dog brains, I see more and more similarities to human brains, you know, certainly in basic responses like emotions. You know, we can see it on the MRIs and it looks like humans. So I think that does kind of raise the awareness that they aren't just, you know, objects and pieces of furniture, but that they do have sentience and that they deserve, you know, treatment as if I would put it on equal footing with a child.
So, Melody, let me take this back to you. What kind of other opportunities does this open up in terms of a high level of social intelligence among dogs, many of whom are trainable because they're eager to please? What other opportunities are there, either with your vest or otherwise?
Well, that's a great question, and I have to totally agree with Greg that dogs are what you make of them. They have raw materials, but spending time with them is the key. And so one of the things we're looking at for pet dogs is something like a life alert type of, you know, my grandmother had a life alert type of necklace, but she didn't like to wear it because it was cumbersome and it wasn't pretty and she didn't like it. And so if she one time fell down in her kitchen and was stranded there for a couple hours until her neighbor heard her calling for help, but what if her little poodle could have been trained to touch some icons on a touchscreen that was mounted on the wall in the kitchen to summon help, to let me know she had fallen down, or to let the neighbor know that she had fallen down by sending a text message to her cell phone. So we are looking for more mainstream applications as well with this type of technology. We do have a touchscreen that dogs can activate, and it works quite well.
And let me bring this back to you then, Greg. What is your next thing you'd most like to learn about dog intelligence? I'm hesitant because of what you said to say the word intelligence, but that's the only thing I can think of.
Well, what we're there are several projects that we're working on, and kind of two of the ones that are on the front burners. One is we're trying to understand self-control in dogs. Now, dogs aren't generally known for having a lot of self-control.
Yeah.
They can do it.
Especially around pizza.
Yes. They can do it, but it's not their forte. And part of this has to do with the way their brain is structured. They don't have big frontal lobes. So we're trying to understand that by giving them tasks while they're actually in the MRI where they have to exert self-control. And so we're exploring a theory that basically says that there is a limited amount, kind of like gas in the tank, and when it's exhausted, self-control goes out the window. And we're trying to identify that so that essentially we can boost it and train it. The other thing that we're very interested in is more along the lines of social intelligence, and we too are doing studies on face processing in humans to try to understand how, or in dogs, and how the dogs process human faces, specifically what parts of their brain are devoted to that. It's not really been demonstrated in any other species besides primates that that there are dedicated parts of the brain for faces, and so we're seeing kind of the first inklings of that in dogs right now.
My guest, Melody Jackson of the Center for Biointerface Research at Georgia Tech. George Barnes is with the Center for Neuropolicy at Emory University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a dog, you know what to do. Send us a picture. Tweet it to us at OST Talk or post it on our Facebook page. But in addition to that photo, tell us, what is the first thing you think your dog would say if he or she could speak? If you think you have your dog's voice nailed down, call us. And you can leave a message at 404-500-9457. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. More than 1,700 people signed an online petition to protest updates to the dress code at Rome High School. The petition claims the new rules affect girls more than boys and, quote, the way in which the dress code has been discussed promotes objectification, over-sexualization, and rape culture, end quote. We asked the student who started that petition to explain, and she brings us this commentary.
My name is Chloe Tilton. I'm 15 years old, and I live in Rome, Georgia. This dress code was displayed on a PowerPoint that the principal sent to our teachers to show us. Definitely sexist the way they had it. I mean, they had a picture of a dude with his pants sagging and a hat on, but they didn't have any equivalent to the skirt. So fingertip length was unemployed. Probably about 5 inches above the knee was risk taker. Right at the knee was a go-getter. Cautious was under the knee. Traditional was mid-calf. And conservative, you're finally conservative if it's at your ankles. It made me feel like my education wasn't as important as what I was wearing. When I walk down the halls, people are scared of getting dress coded by administrators or assistant principals when we should be focusing on our classes, and it's caused more of a disruption than dress code has in the past. And I feel like that's not fair to some of these kids that are really trying in their classes and they're not allowed to make it up because they got sent home for wearing a wrong shirt.
That's Rome High School student Chloe Tilton. Principal Eric Holland has said there are no plans to change the school's dress code or how it's imposed. A flood devastated Rome, Georgia in 1886. According to local lore, the waters rose high enough for a steamboat to float down Broad Street, that's the town's main thoroughfare. This event inspired city leaders to elevate the street and all the buildings along it. Business owners recently opened up their basement doors for people to tour the remains of old Rome. GPB's Emily Curitan brings us this audio postcard.
I'm Catherine Jackson. You'll go to 5 different locations, first levels and basements throughout Broad Street just to see the different history and the different levels. So.
All right, everybody come this way, please. So I'm Rob, and I volunteer for the Sexual Assault Center on things like this and fundraising, and I'm a born and raised in Rome, Georgia, and that's about me. Keep coming. Don't be afraid. You might be afraid when we're done, but not right now. Keep coming. Come on. Come on. Everybody come on down. Come on. Come on. You will see that right back there is a walled up window. Now think about the fact that we are underground. They're not going to put a window to look at the dirt that is underneath the street. And I'm standing in the elevator. So if I'm bringing stuff in through the back, probably off of wagons, bringing it to an elevator, what am I carrying? Anybody guess? No guesses. Cotton, maybe, probably not. If it is, it's not much. What's that?
Supplies.
Maybe food, maybe clothing, maybe other things, maybe a little bit of cotton, right? So we know that William Whitley owned this building. William Whitley was a merchant. He registered himself in the city as a merchant. We also know that William Whitley registered himself as the undertaker for Rome, Georgia. So picture that maybe this next floor might have been the grocery store, the general store with corn and beef, and the next one might be the undertaker, so you have the bodies on the one side and you have the corn and the beef on the other side. If you have questions, please feel free to ask. Seriously, come over and look at it. I wouldn't stand on the elevator itself, not because it won't hold you, but because there's a crack. So there are some places in Rome, Georgia that are haunted. I believe it. You were probably up at the theater. You probably heard about Ruby and or the others.
Did she tell you about Ruby?
I bet it's the same story.
I'm Hannah Cook.
Well, the story, there used to be a trolley car on Broad. Of course, that's gone too once they raised the road and everything. But the story is that this little girl came and she was getting off the trolley and she fell and she got hit. And she got up and she went in and she watched all day because they would have back-to-back features. And when the day was over, she was gone. And she was dead. I'd end the theater, like, doing something she loved, watching these movies.
Do I believe in ghosts? I don't know. I'm not going to say no because I've never seen one. But I'm not going to say yes because I've never seen one. Rebecca Sharp. We live in Collinsville, Alabama, just about 45 minutes away.
New group. All right. Hey, guys. How's it going? Pay attention to this. Don't trip over it.
I'm Chris Jackson.
This will be the trap door I'm talking about, okay? I'm going to go ahead and walk down.
I've kind of helped put together the tour along with Mark Cochran, who's a local architect, and then a bunch of volunteers.
This is it's a water-powered engine that actually powered the elevator that brought cotton up and down.
My favorite thing about this is that we're upstairs in a bike shop, which is currently, you know, functioning as a business. There was a guy up there buying a bike while we were coming through, and then you walk down a flight of stairs and literally you're in the 1800s.
That was used in order to be able to sell cotton. Because what block is this?
Cotton.
Right.
Cotton.
Absolutely. And they call it that because cotton was king in the late 1800s when this building was built.
That piece was produced by GPB's Emily Curitan. To see pictures of her journey to underground Rome, visit gpbnews.org. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. If you're a fan of NPR's Tiny Desk Concerts, you've probably heard Tank and the Bangas. The New Orleans group won this year's NPR Tiny Desk Contest. The band comes to Atlanta this weekend for One Music Fest. GPB's Sean Powers caught up with the lead singer.
My name is Tariana Tank Ball, and I am the lead singer of Tank and the Bangas, and we are from New Orleans, Louisiana.
The moment you tie your own shoes, or spelled your name in your alphabet soup, or told your mom that you're walking to the bus stop by yourself. Don't talk to strangers.
I started mixing in music with my poetry because I guess I was born in New Orleans, and being around people like Asia Rainey and Sonny Patterson and Catalyst and Icon the artist, we always mixed our music with our poetry because it was where we were from. There is a piece that I go back to my experiences, my experience with Katrina.
Hurricane Katrina, the monster storm bearing down on New Orleans, coastal Mississippi, and coastal Alabama. Katrina downgraded.
I think about my grandma's house a lot and how safe and awesome it felt. And I go through the emotions of literally crawling through a window just to get inside her home. And I've never had to do that before. And going in her home and seeing it absolutely ripped apart and thinking about the fact that my grandma wanted to stay in New Orleans and we convinced her to leave with us and how she would have died if she would have stayed. Well, it's a poem and it starts off, it was a direct hit. The splash went smash. The house crumbled beneath the weight. There's water, water everywhere and not a drop to drink. I miss my grandmother's house. She had the type of neighborhood that would have grandchildren swarming like bees, hoping to lick the nectar of 25-cent frozen cups from Miss Ella down the street. Wasn't no such thing as the flavor of strawberry. You see, we lived in color. Like, can I have a red, please? I remember getting up early to Christian Union Baptist Church where my grandfather, Reverend Bradford, was the pastor. Cranberry juice and communion crackers, Chris the ushers, and my grandmama at the door. But grandmama is not here no more, and no longer is her home. And at least when grandparents were leaving, we would still have their homes. The scent of their recipes still cooking on them stoves. And some people still ask us why we sing those Wade in the Water songs or why we write those Katrina poems, because I still miss my grandmother's house. I think that the storm touched with my music or influenced my music in a way of how important it is to feel home even when you're not there, to remember things that are special to you that only New Orleans people can know about.
If anybody ever forgot to tell you, you are important. You are special even. Your body was made especially extravagant, extra human.
The backstory behind Human was just feeling really impossible one day. And I remember listening to a poet say, if you break down the word impossible, I'm possible. I think it's so true. When people say stuff like, I'm just human, I mean, what do you expect from me? I'm just human. I think that's a cop-out. Like, this is an incredible thing to be. This is an incredible person to be. This is a living thing. And when you watch the Olympics and when you see singers and actors remember a million lines, to be human is to be an incredible life force. Don't weaken it.
You should play with him. I'm sure your attention won't cause a deficient amount in nerve cells. Us women, we blink nearly twice as much as men, so keep looking. She'll notice you. May take her a little longer, but she's got to. The average human heart will beat over 1 million times in one lifetime. I am sure you'll find someone who won't mind skipping one for you.
I see Tank in the bangers. In New Orleans, I haven't seen a woman head a group of guys like this in a long time. And New Orleans needs that. New Orleans needs the next amazing group of creativity coming out and sharing it with the world so they could know what goes on down here. It's important. It's special, and it always has been. And I'm excited for people to see that. It's dope to be a gutsy chick. It really is. To say some of the things I say or you say and do it, it's dope. And it feels free. And that is the only way to live this life.
It's so beautiful, special. Yes, you are.
That's Tarianna Tank Ball. She's the lead singer of the New Orleans band Tank and the Bangas. The group performs Saturday at Atlanta's One Music Fest. You can get details at gpbnews.org.